Those Who Are Humble. The fourth talk in a series entitled Those Who Belong to God was presented by Ron Julian on September 8, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Out of a willingness to see the world in a new way. And that if we don't have that willingness to see the world in a new way, then it doesn't really matter whether we believe in Jesus or not. And fundamentally, I mean, in one way we could put it is that belief in the gospel is almost like a symptom of something deeper that is happening in our lives. So some of the things we've talked about so far, we've talked about loving God, we've talked about fearing God, we talked about desiring God's kingdom more than the treasures of this world. And I have tried to communicate, I hope I have communicated in talking about this, that these qualities, as I see the Bible describing them and as I see it worked out in our lives, they're basically latent in us. They emerge over time through trials and tribulations in life. That being the basically lazy and self-centered people that we are, that we would just as soon, and we would be glad to, avoid the implications of our faith in Jesus if we could, because those implications are difficult and painful to deal with in this life. But God, out of His mercy, doesn't let us do that, and basically comes along and confronts us with the issues implicit in our faith as we go through life. And so we have to face into the question, do I love God? Do I want to love Him? Do I know who He is? Do I want what it is He has to offer? These things are an essential part of what it means to be a believer. Today, I want to talk about a quality which is probably very familiar to us around here. In fact, I don't know, maybe everybody's going to groan. We talk about this a lot around here. Some people say we talk about it too much around here. But I think it's unavoidable if we're going to talk about those qualities that characterize the people of God. One of them that we have to talk about is the fact that the children of God are those who are humble before Him. And in particular, what I want to concentrate on is the children of God are those that know that they're sinners. Now, before I start looking at a few passages that talk about this, I want to, maybe it'll help to start with a clarification. And maybe this is not a problem for you all, but I have run into this in the past, and I want to try to see if I can catch it before we get started. There are those, I mean, believe it or not, there are people who have occasionally taken it upon themselves to disagree with me, or people at the study center who have actually criticized the way we approach things. I know it's difficult to imagine, but there are such people in the world. And one of the criticisms that I have gotten and that we have gotten is that we talk about sin too much. I know that people think this because they have gone out of their way to tell me that we do this. And there are various alternatives that have been proposed to me. Some basically just think that we have too gloomy a proclamation around here, and we need to talk more positively about the good things in this life and the good things that we can accomplish in this life and the good causes that we can get involved in and so on. There are others who complain that the way we talk about sin around here makes them feel insignificant. They need to hear more about how God loves them, not about what a sinful mess they are. Well, I have a sort of an on the one hand and on the other hand sort of response to this, which probably won't surprise anybody. This is the way I respond to everything. On the one hand, I agree very much that there is an inappropriate kind of self-hatred, a destructive self-criticism that is not in accordance with the truth, it is not biblical, and it is something we should strive to avoid. Sometimes in our brokenness as people, for various reasons, we get to feeling that we are worthless, that somehow other people deserve love and good things, but that we don't. And sometimes we can get the feeling that looking around us and seeing the world, seeing our own lives and looking around and seeing what's going on in the world around us, we can get the feeling that life in a fallen world is pointless and meaningless and futile and hardly worth going on. And it seems to me that there are truths that are fueling these perversions, which makes them harder to deal with. But the fact is, they are perversions. First of all, I am not a piece of garbage. I am a creation of God that is broken and flawed. I am not a piece of dirt on the ground. I am like this great creation. I'm a BMW. But the problem is that my steering goes out all the time and I run over people. I'm like a diamond, only the facets are cut so sharp that everybody that wears me cuts their hand on me. I mean, there's this great value, but there's something wrong at the same time. That's what I'm trying to get at. I am not nothing. I am something gone wrong, something significant, something worthwhile that has a big problem. There's a difference between being worthless and being significant but flawed. Now, ultimately, my flaws are deep, and that's what we want to talk about here. We don't want to just ignore them. But the fact is that those flaws don't turn me into nothing. And the people around me, if I have that sense that they are worth somehow the significance, worth honor, worth love and appreciation by the people around me, then I am no less worthy of that. And if I have the sense that that's not true, then I don't understand things. It's difficult to put these two things together. In fact, I noticed today, I don't know if any of you saw Parade magazine today in the paper, but there's an article by the rabbi who wrote the book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And the title of it, I forget what it was, it's something like, Do I Have to Be Perfect? And, pardon me? How good do we have to, I guess something like that, And I didn't read the whole thing, I didn't have time this morning, but his basic argument was that certain religious teachings have given us the idea that if you are not perfect, then you are not worthy of love, is the way he talked about it. And the problem is that I think he's sort of confusing categories as he puts things together, because on the one hand, I think he's right, that we can have the idea that somehow I am less worthy than others and get an inappropriate idea of my own place in the world. But at the same time, he was saying things like, I believe in a God who knows how complicated life is and knows how difficult it is to be good. And this is a God who, you know, it's basically an A for effort sort of God that he was saying that he believes in. And that's exactly the spot where, I think it seems to me that he knows that he's taking on Christianity as a target when he's saying that. And I accept the status as a target. He's right. We don't agree on that at all. There's all a difference in the world between saying I am significant as a creature of God and God is impressed with my efforts towards goodness. Those are not at all the same thing. Understanding the difference between those two things has a lot to do with whether I really understand my situation in life, I think. And same thing is true with the question of the meaninglessness of life. There's a sense in which that's true. I mean, Ecclesiastes had it right. Go and read Ecclesiastes and see what it says about vanity and futility and all of that. It's right, but that's not the end of the story. Ultimately, what we understand is that as the people of God, our lives are meaningful journeys toward an appropriate and desirable end. So yes, there are futilities and frustrations, but my life now is not nothing. And this is something that I've really had to struggle with and wrestle with myself in the past years, because to me, especially, I don't know, past 3 years of my life have been very, very difficult. And there have been times when I am real tempted to think, it's not worth it. I don't want to do this anymore. I just want out. But part of what I have had to wrestle with myself is the recognition that that's not... The focus on the hope that we have in the gospel is not the same thing as saying that where I am now is meaningless. It's not true. This is a journey. There is something significant about where I am now. And so, ultimately, the futilities of this life become meaningful and ultimately significant because God is using them to accomplish something. So, I'm saying all of that stuff because I want to clarify that when I say that understanding that we are sinners is one of the central realities in the heart of the believer, I'm not trying to fuel self-hatred and a sense of hopelessness and worthlessness in life. On the contrary, I think coming to understand what our problem is, if we then understand something of the God that we are serving and who is saving us, we come to understand how great the salvation is that He is offering. The more we understand how significant the problem is, the more we understand how great the salvation that He's offering is. Because that's the real problem that we face, is in the middle of my life when I have all kinds of things that I would like God to take care of, and He doesn't. I mean, maybe He does, but oftentimes He doesn't. It doesn't seem like He does to me. I can find myself asking that question, so what's God doing? Why isn't He on my side? Why doesn't He come along and help me? If He loves me so much, why doesn't He do something? But the fact is that He is doing something. He's doing something better than I can even imagine. And that's the message that we have to take from the gospel, that the salvation that God is bringing about is what I really need. And part of what has to come home to me in understanding that is to recognize how much of my problem relates to the problems that sin brings into my life and into the life of the world. So the more I understand what the problem is, the more I'm prepared ultimately to see how great the salvation is that God is bringing about. And so the ultimate outcome of it should be positive. It should be encouraging and uplifting. But you have to go, you can't really get to a great salvation without having a problem first. Being rescued doesn't, you know, we've talked about this before, but being rescued is not a big deal if you're not in any danger. If there's no problem and I come along and say, ta-da, I've saved you, and you go, oh, that's great. I mean, what else can you say? I mean, if you hadn't showed up, things would have been exactly as they are, so what's the big deal? It's when I recognize that I really need to be rescued and what I need to be rescued from that the salvation that God offers starts to become significant. Okay, so, I mean, I know I don't look like it, but I really am a positive person when it comes right down to it. You just have to go a while to find it, but okay. So that was my on the one hand. But on the other hand, the fact is I am convinced. I keep going back to the Bible and finding over and over and over again the theme that the people of God have to come to terms with the deep problem of sin. Not just, oh yeah, I'm a sinner, but I'm messed up. It runs deep. I need mercy. To conclude that I need mercy from God and that I can't really go to Him and ask for justice. Hey, God, give me what I deserve. But to understand in my heart that mercy is my only hope, that is the thing that characterizes the people of God. And I'm getting the impression that it is an incredibly big issue, that it surfaces in all kinds of things that we see in the Bible. So I guess I'm unapologetic in a sense in insisting that being a person who knows myself to be a sinner, that's significant and crucially significant. There are a lot of things that we could look at. In John 7, Jesus said, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its deeds are evil." So, I mean, here Jesus is basically tying the response to Himself with the lack of willingness to have the light shown on the evil in a person's life. Just as in other places, we saw last time we were together that in John, Jesus connects the response to himself with our desires, what it is we want in life. If we're looking for the worldly bread, if we're looking for the worldly glory, then we're not going to be interested in him. Well, here he's tying the response to himself with our willingness to be shown up for what we are. And I think ultimately it's unavoidable. I mean, the very gospel that we believe, this is something I've said a lot, I know, but the very gospel that we're embracing and believing, at the center of that gospel is a cross. And Jesus is hanging on that cross. The Messiah, God become man, is hanging on that cross and dying because of what? Not because he deserved to be there, but because I deserve to be there. I mean, the cross, as much as it is a message of the mercy of God, before it is a message of the mercy of God, it is a message of condemnation. It is ultimately God saying, here's what I think of your sin. This is what it deserves. Jesus ultimately wasn't humiliated on the cross. We were. I mean, it's our humiliation that he was bearing there. To accept the gospel, then, means to accept the verdict of God on my life. I'm taking the verdict of guilty at the same time that I'm accepting the sweetness of the mercy that God is providing. And the mercy wins. The mercy ultimately takes away all the bitterness of the guilt, but we have to start with the guilt. If we think about the books of Romans and Galatians, which clearly have had such an incredible impact on the life of the church, think about the role that Romans and Galatians played in the Reformation. Think about the deep issues that those books talk about. And for me, those books have had a big impact on my relationship with God. I can remember when it started to hit home to me that some of that language about not being justified by works of the law and the grace to be found in the gospel really started to hit home to me personally out of the books of Romans and Galatians especially. Well, what are those books talking about? In different situations, both books are addressing the problem of what we refer to as legalism. Legalism is only possible when intense self-deception about sin is going on. What we know is that the law of God is intended to bring us to our knees, ultimately. For instance, in Romans 3:19, it's always an unnerving thing to talk about Romans when Jack is in the room. It's like I'm thinking, say, oh, he knows that this isn't what this says, but well, just tough. 3:19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. For through the law comes the knowledge of sin. I mean, it's a fairly clear statement of Paul's that the law of God is intended to shut us up, essentially, to end any claims that we might have before God, any claims on his blessing. We don't have those claims. The law has made it clear that we don't have those claims. Well, the law doesn't have that effect in the life of a legalist. I mean, that's what makes the legalist a legalist, is someone who has come to the law, but the law has not shut them up. The law has not brought them to their knees, but instead they look at it, they put the whole system together, and they say, yeah, I can do that. That looks pretty good. I mean, actually, I'm pretty good at doing this. A lot better than those guys over there. And that's the kind of people that Paul was dealing with. This is an incredible delusion. The truth about oneself that the law was intended to bring about, the law has not had that effect in the life of the legalist. So in Romans 10, when Paul's talking about his Jewish opponents who do not believe the gospel, right at the beginning of 10, brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for them is for their salvation, for I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. For not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. And that theme, and we see it earlier up in 9 too, Israel pursuing a law of righteousness did not arrive at that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as though it were by works. This idea that, especially when you look at a group like the Pharisees, who were intently interested in the law and studied it and wanted their lives to conform to it, when we look at the teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, much of the Sermon on the Mount is intended to show up the shallowness and hypocrisy of the obedience of the Pharisees to the law. That they found a way of taking commandments and interpreting them and twisting them in such a way that they could look at their own essentially unchanged, worldly, self-centered, ungodly lives and say, I match, I fit this description that's found in that law. Whereas that law was intended to stand up solid and unshakable as the standard of what goodness and godliness and righteousness would look like, so that we can see clearly where we stand in relationship to it. So the great books of the Bible that talk about justification by faith, that talk about how it's not our works that justify us, but it is the grace of God found in the cross, those very books confront us with the essential requirement that we face into the reality of our own sinfulness. That's what the faith in Jesus, in large part, is based on. It is a rejection of the way of the law and embracing the grace that Jesus is providing. That's where the book of Galatians becomes so significant to us, because whereas in Romans, Paul is talking to Jewish unbelievers. I mean, he's not talking to them, but he's talking about them. He's addressing his arguments to the arguments of those who were Jews and who didn't believe in Jesus at all. But in Galatians, Paul is addressing the arguments of the Judaizers, which were Jewish, mostly Pharisees, who believed that Jesus was the Messiah. They heard the story about his death and resurrection, and they believed it, and they became disciples of the way. But their argument was, there's no way that the Gentiles could be accepted before God if they don't keep the law the way we do. And Paul, in Galatians, minces no words when he gives his judgment on this position. The very first thing in the book, basically, he's saying, may they be accursed. They're teaching a different gospel. And his basic message throughout that book is, you had better not be listening to them, because if your heart can embrace a perversion of the gospel like this, then you're lost. You are absolutely lost. Think about how he ends up in Galatians 5. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. And he's talking about freedom from the law there. Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You have been severed from Christ, you who are seeking to be justified by law. You have fallen from grace. For we, through the Spirit, by faith, are waiting for the hope of righteousness. So, a very clear alternative there. You can take on the task of pleasing God through the law, or you can, by faith, wait for the hope of righteousness that He has promised. What's significant about that in Galatians is that these are people who believe in Jesus, who would have answered correctly many of the doctrinal statements that we would put forward to say this is how you can tell whether somebody's in or out. But at the heart, in spite of the fact that they believed the story about Jesus, they still were essentially, many of them, self-righteous. They were still essentially attracted to a message that said, God is going to find you acceptable if you do A, B, C, and D. And He doesn't find those Gentiles acceptable because they're not doing that. There's something very attractive about that kind of a message to us, because we find it very attractive to be able to look at ourselves and basically say, I'm okay. That's what a law can do for you. If you don't get the point of a law, then a law can come along and give you a set of criteria that you can meet and feel good about yourself. That's the danger of a law. I mean, I know that God knew the danger of the law when he gave it, but we have to recognize what a risky thing God was doing, in a sense, to take people like us and give us a law and say, here, it looks like this. Because, I mean, what happens is Pharisees. That's what you get from giving people a law, is you get a whole bunch of people who say, okay, and never really understand the point of the law that was given. Well, from my perspective, the clearest, the most important teaching in the Bible on this theme is a very simple story that I think sometimes we can miss how radical it is in what it's saying. Very familiar. Gosh, talk about this around here all the time. But we're talking about a parable in Luke 18, starting in verse 9, the parable of the tax gatherer and the Pharisee. I think that this is one of the most amazing stories that Jesus tells. I mean, this is one of the great parables, I think. It's not particularly complicated, but the thing that it's teaching cuts very, very deep. Now, okay, so it starts out, he also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax gatherer. Part of what makes this story amazing, I think, is that we have to get clear in our minds right off the bat. We are inclined to think, I mean, in our cultural situation, we use the word Pharisee as a swear word. Oh, that Pharisee. And we have a phrase, I mean, it's sort of, you don't hear people using it a lot, but because of the parable of the... the Pharisee, that's what I was going to start talking about another parable. I don't know what happened to my mind there. I should look at my notes. Oh, this is Luke 18. Oh, yeah, right. Never mind. I'm just getting warmed up for when I go to this other church and really dazzle them. Okay. What we have to understand in this story is actually, maybe in our culture, is not so hard to understand, is that to the people hearing this story, the Pharisees would have been the good guys, and the tax gatherer would have been the bad guy. Now, maybe in our culture, that's not so hard to understand, that the tax gatherer would be the bad guy. But I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but we're talking about someone who collected taxes for the Romans, who were the conquerors, the overlords, the ones who had robbed the people of Israel of their freedom, their sovereignty over their own land. And the tax gatherer usually was a fellow Jew who decided, hey, if I cuddle up with the Romans here, I can profit by this quite a bit. And they did, because they basically had the freedom to collect whatever taxes they wanted. They had the responsibility, as I understand it. The Romans would say, I expect this much from you. And as long as they could make that amount and give it to the Romans would be happy. Meanwhile, they could take care of themselves by whatever else they could get on top of that. So people hated the tax gatherers. They really hated them. And with a certain amount of just cause. These were not good guys. In comparison, the Pharisee really was a model citizen. I mean, this was a godly, pious person who taught people to follow the law and to pray to God and so on. I mean, there's no question that people would have looked at these two figures as the Pharisee is a godly person and the tax gatherer is an ungodly person. So, what's so striking in this story is the way the tables are turned. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank thee that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. Now, this is true. I mean, there's nothing particularly untrue about what the Pharisee is saying, accept this idea that somehow he has entered into this place of blessing that does not belong to other people, that somehow he is worthy. His life, he's got it together, whereas the other folks don't. There is this deception about himself that's at the heart of what he's saying. The outward differences that he's describing between his life and others, they're true. I mean, he didn't commit adultery. He didn't rob people. What was true about him at heart and in his life, that's the part that he really doesn't get. The tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. And what has to be striking in this story, would have especially been striking to the people of the time, is that the tax collector goes home justified. He's saying essentially God accepts the tax collector and he doesn't accept the Pharisee. The Pharisee is cast out and the tax collector is gathered in. Why? What a strange thing to have happen. An ungodly person like the tax collector is embraced by God. Why? Because he is humble. Because he knows himself for what he is. And he goes to God not seeking approval, but knowing he couldn't get that approval because of who he is, and seeking mercy instead. So, I mean, the story is meant to bring home very strongly the idea that ultimately the one who finds favor with God is not the one who accomplishes a good and righteous life and thus merits God's favor, but the one who sees himself as in need of the mercy of God. It's the person who needs the mercy of God and knows it that ultimately is going to find acceptance. Now, there's a tension here, it seems to me, that is very important for us to come to terms with. Because on the one hand, the Bible describes us as God's people in terms that talk about us as if in some sense there's something good about us. I mean, there are the righteous and the wicked. When Jesus comes back, he's going to gather the righteous up into his Father's kingdom, and the wicked are going to be cast out. Well, he's nominating you and me for the role of the righteous in that scenario, which, if you've looked at yourself lately, may seem like a strange sort of description. I mean, I find myself wrestling with that description at times. But there is something that's good and right about the people of God. There is this sense in which we are coming to be people who are embracing the truth, who are following it, who are seeking after what is good. So on the one hand, if we were to say that there is nothing but evil, there is nothing necessary to be true about the people of God except that they know that they're sinners, that would be a falsehood. There's this draw towards things that are good and right that is a part of what it means to be a believer, and I don't want to downplay that. But on the other hand, we have to be people who know ourselves and know that we are not worthy before God. So there are these two ways you can go, both of which are the wrong way. You can be a person who's kind of up on the idea of, yeah, there's right and good, and I need to get my life together and do what is righteous and appropriate. And down that road, it is very easy to turn into a Pharisee, essentially, to embrace the good, but in doing so, fool myself into thinking that I've really got it together. On the other side, there can be a kind of honesty about, yeah, I don't have it together, my life isn't what it ought to be, but no particular interest in the good or the right. We are living in this perilous sort of tension right in the middle, where on the one hand, we are committed to the good and pursuing it, and we value it, and we approve of it. And we disapprove of what is evil, and we seek after what is good. And yet at the same time, even while we are seeking after what is good, we know that we're not there. We know ourselves to be less than what we ought to be. And so that ultimately, I am one who is seeking after good, but I know that I am not going to earn the reward of the righteous, because I am not one. Ultimately, if the inheritance of the righteous comes to me, it is going to be because of the mercy of God. So I am pursuing good under God's mercy. That's the place where the believing life is lived, I think. If either of those is missing, then there's something wrong. Something is, the biblical picture of what it means to be a believer is not there. So there is that tension. But whichever side of it we're standing on, I think it's always appropriate for us to remind ourselves of the other side. I don't want to be indifferent to what is good and right. There'd be something very dangerous about being blasé about good and evil in this world. And yet at the same time, I have to be honest. I'm not what I ought to be. That means it's significant that I'm a sinner, because good is something that I value, and yet I see that what I see in myself is not always what I value. The thing that I look at and say, that's good, that's not what I find. That's a painful place to live. But as believers, if we have come to understand the God we are following, we know that He forgives us, we have mercy, and that we have hope. That it is not futile in this life to want what is good, to seek after it, because ultimately that's the whole point. That's the salvation that God is bringing about. The good that we are seeking is the exact thing that we're ultimately going to find. So, I guess in a nutshell, I'm saying that we can't avoid this. A believer in Jesus who has not embraced the idea that he or she is evil and unworthy is basically going to turn into a Pharisee. That's what's going to happen. And it happens a lot. It's out there. We have to take that seriously. It's a strange place to live, but evil people who want to be good are living in a different place than most of the world is living, but that's the point of faith. That's the place where the people of God are going to be living, I think. Well, if I could let you have like 5 minutes maybe for comments, and then I'm going to take off, see how close I can be in getting there on time. But certainly you must have some comments about this.
I think it's always hard to live between those two roads. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you can comment, and this is probably something I think you don't want to comment on, but in light of what you just said, the things that we actually face in like political realms, like the OCA, for example, or also child punishment.
Well, I'm going to step back from I don't know the people involved in the OCA very much, so I don't particularly have anything to say about them as a group. It seems to me that that's one of those places where you find that tension. I mean, you're right to say that tension is right there. And it's very important to recognize it, I think. Because what we're trying to be in this world, I think, is people who are standing for the things that Jesus stands for, trying to hold to what is good, at the same time being people who are merciful because God has been merciful with us. So it seems to me that where we want to be is we want our laws and the system of justice that we embrace, that we live out, that our government is calling us to, we want that to reflect what is good and right. But our attitude as citizens and in dealing with each other under that law ought to be a recognition that I, by the standards of God's justice, deserve condemnation, and so I have no place to stand to condemn you. The problem is, in our social setting, it seems to me that there are two problems. One problem we have brought upon ourselves, I think, in that much of the church, from my perspective, I don't know if anybody else agrees with me on this, but from my perspective, much of the church's message about these kinds of issues has actually been partly, at least partly, motivated by self-righteousness, I think. And so our message has come across not just we stand for what is good, but we sure are glad, you know, I thank you, God, that I'm not like other men. That's basically come across, I think, pretty clearly. And I've told this story many times, but it really struck me. This was a long time ago, back in the Dade County stuff. Anita Bryant and they were having some sort of gay rights, either a gay rights law they were fighting against or an anti-gay rights law they were supporting. I can't remember which way it went, but there was a press conference I remember where Anita Bryant's husband sort of put his arm around her and he said, "This is what us straight folks do." And there was something about the sort of smugness in his tone and sort of, "I sure am glad I'm not one of those perverts," that I found very offensive, especially because that whole campaign was being waged sort of in the name of Christianity. So it seems to me that part of the problem is that we have brought upon ourselves is that it is difficult for people to hear us anymore, because as soon as we start to talk about what we think the standard of right and wrong is, the assumption is that we're speaking out of that same sort of self-righteous place that many people have. On the other hand, it is very attractive, I think, for people who want to pursue a certain way of life and who would like our culture to go in a certain way, to dismiss their opponents as being unworthy to listen to because they're self-righteous. And so, frankly, even if we, I think, clearly communicate what it is we see as, you know, our own flaws, that, you know, speaking to the homosexual community, saying, "Look, there's no difference between your worthiness and my worthiness. We stand as flawed sinners before God." But it's not going to do you any good to pursue evil and call it good. And that's why I'm speaking to you. To bring that message to that community, it's going to be a miracle of God if they're willing to listen to that, I think. Because in order to hear that, you start to have to make distinctions and categories that ultimately are going to rip your whole view of the world apart. And most people are not willing to start embracing categories and distinctions that rip their whole world apart. So I think the distinction you're making, bringing that distinction into the political arena, I think it is important. And I have not been happy personally with how the church has handled some of those kinds of issues. Not the stance so much as the attitude that has been displayed. When it comes to capital punishment, I think the same kind of distinction can be made. I'm not making any proclamation one way or the other on capital punishment, but I'm just saying that let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that capital punishment could be seen as part of a just system of laws, that a legal system could have capital punishment and be just, that there's no necessary contradiction between the idea that I would want mercy for, that I would forgive the person who has done a terrible thing and yet approve of the state executing them, saying, "Yes, our justice system needs to function and you need to pay the price socially for what it is you've done. At the same time, my prayer is that God will have mercy on you." I don't think there's necessarily a contradiction between those things. But again, when we see that sort of, you know, holding the signs and saying, "Fry him," kind of stuff, there's that sense of, you know, you want to kind of hold up a mirror and say, have you looked lately? You know. So, anyway, anything else? Maybe one more and then I should go. Okay, well, with that, I'm done.